Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today, we're going to be talking about the Newsweek cover story for this week. It's a big one. The title, right there on the front of the magazine, is The Decline and Fall of Christian America. It's by John Meacham, the editor of the magazine. The article headline on the inside is The End of Christian America. It's more than a passing matter of interest. As a matter of fact, Mr. Meacham talked to me, and as we will find out, there's a good deal in this article that's basically an interaction between the editor of Newsweek and with me on the question of whether or not we're living in a post-Christian America. I think there's a big issue here. I think this is the kind of thing that ought to lead Christians to think and to have some good conversation about what it means to live in an America that's experiencing so much change. And I've been writing so much about this at my website at albertmohler.com. We've been talking about it on this program, and it's obviously garnered some attention outside some circles where that might be expected, because it turns out that for very different reasons, a lot of people in different sectors of the society are noticing the same thing. Some think it's a good development. Some think it's a very ominous development. But everyone's agreed that it is a big and important development, and that is the great shift going on in America right now that might be well described as a shift to a post-Christian condition. And we've been talking about that a lot. We're going to talk about it today. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Just about this time of the year, as also at the Christmas season, the major newsweeklies come out with a big cover story having to do with some kind of religious theme. Newsweek has chosen this theme. It's a stark black cover, red text, The Decline and Fall of Christian America. There are some folks who are upset about the story, saying that it's extremely negative. They see it as something of an attack on Christianity. I really don't see it that way. I think it's a very interesting essay. I think it demands our attention, and we're going to be talking about it, and we'll get to that in just a moment. First, a review of some issues in the news. We're still trying to take into full account the impact of last week's decision by the Iowa Supreme Court legalizing same-sex marriage, but this much is clear. It's big. And as we look at it and try to put it into an historical and sociological context, here is why it's so big. First of all, this is the first inland state, so to speak, the first heartland state to legalize same-sex marriage. And we're not just talking here about civil unions or domestic partnerships. We're talking about gay marriage. We're talking about a sweeping, unanimous decision by the Iowa Supreme Court that cited the Equal Protection Clause of the Iowa State Constitution in saying that they were obligated by their understanding of the Iowa Constitution to say that homosexuals have been discriminated against as a class of people when it comes to marriage. Justice Mark S. Cady asked this question. He said, "The class of people ask a simple and direct question. How can a state premised on the constitutional principle of equal protection justify exclusion of a class of Iowans from civil marriage?" End quote. Time Magazine answers Michael Lindenberger by saying the answer is it can't. Well, that's the answer that this state came to, but it's really interesting to see how it got there. And I think the most interesting aspect of all of this, and we're going to be talking about this tomorrow on this program, is what it means to identify someone on the basis of sexuality as a protected class, because that's what's really behind this. In California, the state Supreme Court there, in ruling for same-sex marriage, a ruling that, by the way, it was reversed by the people on November the 4th of last year in Proposition 8, but a ruling that even now is before that same court again. Last year, the California Supreme Court said that homosexuals are a protected class, and as a protected class, any kind of discrimination against them must meet the standard of what's called strict scrutiny, which means an incredibly high level of suspicion constitutionally against any measure that would discriminate in any way against homosexuals. Well, what's interesting there is that this is now a protected class, not on the basis of race or ethnicity or some kind of legal status, but rather on the status of sexuality. And now you have the Iowa Supreme Court, which, by the way, did not raise the issue to strict scrutiny, but rather to an intermediate level of scrutiny. That's legal speech for saying they still recognized homosexual persons as a protected class. Once that happens, the big issue is, well, then who's next? You know, if you're going to decide that homosexuality now represents the status of a protected class of individuals, Well, let's face it, the range of human sexuality goes far beyond heterosexual and homosexual. We're right in the world now of what Sigmund Freud called polymorphous perversity. And I wrote about polymorphous perversity, which means the fact that human perversity can take any number of different shapes and forms. It is, by definition, polymorphous. I wrote about that in my book on sex, desire, and deceit that came out just a few months ago. Because that's exactly where we are right now. And that's why, for instance, at your local college or university, you have a gay rights office. It's not gay rights anymore. It's not gay and lesbians. It's gay, lesbians, transgender, transsexual, you name it. Because there are any number of different lifestyles and sexual behaviors and sexual relationships. So we're going to have now, apparently, a train of car after car after car of different groups claiming some kind of protected status. And you know that polygamists are next, because they've already told us. And the cases are already in the pipeline. And, as many law professors have already recognized, it's the same argument. It's the same argument. Here you have a justice of the Iowa Supreme Court asking this question. Hear it again. This class of people asks a simple and direct question: how can a state premised on the constitutional principle of equal protection justify exclusion of a class of Iowans from civil marriage? End quote. Well, if marriage is no longer necessarily a man and a woman, it can be a man and a woman, or whatever, then why in the number two? That's discrimination. Of course it's discrimination, because there are people who would rather it be three or four or five. Well, just wait. We'll see where this heads, but it's going to be a good conversation tomorrow. And the big aspect of this, the most urgent aspect in my mind, is what this means for religious liberty, what this means for churches, what this means for Christian colleges and Christian schools in Iowa, and what this means for Iowans who are trying to figure out what it means to be a Christian, to believe that marriage is a God-given institution given to us by our Creator, which is objectively the union of a man and a woman, how we are to think about these things, and how we are to understand what could be a clear and present threat to religious liberty. We'll be talking about that tomorrow on this program. Very interestingly, another big topic in the news today is Islam. President Barack Obama, of course, is today in Turkey. And while he has been in Turkey, he has said, for instance, the United States has been enriched by Muslim Americans. Many other Americans have Muslims in their family or have lived in a Muslim-majority country. I know because I am one of them. Now, the president has thus put the issue of Islam right front and center in terms of the discussion. He says, I know there have been difficulties these last few years. I know that the trust that binds us has been strained, and I know that that strain is shared in many places where the Muslim faith is practiced. So let me say this as clearly as I can. The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam. End quote. Well, that's a very interesting statement. That comes at the same time the Washington Post released a story saying that the Washington Post ABC News poll indicates that as the war in Iraq moves into its fourth year, this actually was back in 2006, this dated report that has just been again brought to the attention of the public by the Washington Post. It says a growing proportion of Americans are expressing unfavorable views of Islam. And so when you start looking at that, you realize that there are going to be a lot of people asking questions about how we should think about Islam, how America should think about Islam. Is Islam a threat? I'll be talking about it tonight on the Roland Martin Show on CNN. That's live tonight at 8 Eastern time. And so I'll look forward to that conversation. I'm going to be on that program. Those of you who have watched these things for years know that at several points over the last several years, I've been locked into a debate with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. And he's going to be on the program tonight. So it's going to be interesting. I can promise you that. I'll be on the Roland Martin Show on CNN tonight at 8 Eastern time. And so will Rabbi Boteach, and also representative of Islam, who will be there as well. So it's going to be a very interesting conversation. I invite you to watch that. And that might give us a lot to talk about tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And we might have to shift some conversations because the world is shifting around us. So we'll be watching to see what goes on. But we do know this. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and there is plenty for us to talk about. Among the things for us to talk about, the Barna Research Group is out with a very interesting study talking about the differences between religious liberals and religious conservatives. And guess what? The differences are theological. Now, there's a no-brainer, but every once in a while, it's good to have some data before us that really points to the reality and makes the issues clear. So we're going to be talking about that later this week as we go on towards Good Friday and, of course, Resurrection Sunday, which is coming before us. It's interesting. And here we are in this week in the year 2009, and it appears that everything the church has ever struggled with or thought about is on the agenda. And you start thinking about the last couple of millennia of Christian history. For at least the last 13 centuries, the Christian church has struggled with understanding what we are to think about Islam. For all of Christian history, we've been trying to think about the place of marriage and the place of sexuality within the Christian life, within creation as the Creator gave it to us. We've been trying to figure out what it means, well, what it means to be a Christian faithful in a world that doesn't play by the rules, that indeed doesn't love God and the gospel. Well, the reality is, this is why the church's first ambition and mission has always been evangelism. Because we understand that that is the first and most important message we have. It's the most important truth we know. It's the difference between life and death. Other issues are important too, and we'll get to those in due time. But the world throws it all to us at once. We're going to come back to talk about Newsweek's cover story, The End of Christian America. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I would introduce today's topic, but frankly, John Meacham does a better job of it in his article as he begins the cover story. It's an essay in this week's issue of Newsweek magazine. I'm just going to read to you from the article, and you'll see why I'm doing it this way. This is how he begins. He says, "It was a small detail, a point of comparison buried in the fifth paragraph on the 17th page of a 24-page summary of the 2009 American Religious Identification Survey. But as R. Albert Mueller, Jr., president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, one of the largest on earth, read over the document after its release in March, he was struck by a single sentence. For a believer like Mueller, a starched, unflinchingly conservative Christian, steeped in the theology of his particular province of the faith, devoted to producing ministers who will preach the inerrancy of the Bible and the gospel of Jesus Christ as the only means to eternal life, the central news of the survey was troubling enough. The number of Americans who claim no religious affiliation has nearly doubled since 1990, rising from 8% to 15%. Then came the point he could not get out of his mind. While the unaffiliated have historically been concentrated in the Pacific Northwest, the report said, this pattern has now changed, and the Northeast emerged in 2008 as the new stronghold of the religiously unidentified. As Mueller saw it, the historic foundation of America's religious culture was cracking." End quote. He goes on to write, "That hit me really hard, he told me last week." That is John Meacham speaking of myself, speaking to him. And I was speaking to him. "That really hit me hard," he told me last week. "The Newsweek, the Northwest was never as religious, never as congregationalized as the Northwest." Excuse me here. It says the Northwest was never as religious, never as congregationalized as the Northeast, which was the foundation, the home base of American religion. "To lose New England struck me as momentous." Well, he's citing me there, and he's citing me correctly. Because as I was looking at that report, I was struck by, and mentioned on this program, that I was struck by the very fact that we're now looking at the Northeast becoming the most secular part of the country. And the reality is, that has always been the Pacific Northwest. And for good reason. The Pacific Northwest was never fully evangelized, never fully congregationalized, like the rest of the country was. It did not have the kind of immigrant churches that you saw, for instance, in the Northeast and in the Midwest, where you have all the German Lutherans and all the rest. It was never a Bible Belt like you see in the Deep South. But let's remember that colonial New England was established by people who were fleeing, largely, by people who were fleeing the old world for the new world, driven by a compulsion for religious liberty and the ability to worship God as they saw fit. And they were Christians who clearly understood a Christian mission that drove them to come all the way across the Atlantic and to colonize North America, beginning there in the American Northeast, as we know it now, the colonial American region. And for the Northeast now to become the most secular part of the country, this is momentous. I wrote about it back in late March, March the 27th, I believe, at my website at albertmueller.com, and it caught the attention of Newsweek. John Meacham called me, and I have to tell you that the essay that John Meacham wrote here is, I think, very, very interesting. Now, he begins by talking about my assessment, because I got to the point of arguing that we're now looking at America becoming, or at least large portions of America becoming, a post-Christian culture. And that's not a term that I invented. It's a term of fairly vintage usefulness now, because especially as you look to Europe, we're looking at a post-Christian reality. We're looking at an entire continent that had once been thoroughly, pervasively, unquestionably shaped by Christianity that is now basically extremely, radically secular in terms of its worldview. Well, it looks like parts of the United States are following the same trajectory. The Northeast now leading the pack. Now, my purpose in writing the article was first and foremost about evangelism. Because I think what this study, actually more than one, now you're looking at the ERA study, also at the Pew Religious Landscape study, these studies help us understand that we're living on one of the most massive, challenging mission fields on earth. We're now surrounded by people who increasingly know that they are not Christians. And one of the things I've said on this program over the last several weeks is that that's actually a gain for us in terms of evangelism, to talk to people who at least know they are not Christians. They don't claim to be Christians. It's easier to have an honest conversation with someone about Christianity who knows that he or she is not a Christian than someone who thinks they are because of some vague family tie or cultural kind of alliance or allegiance. But we're now looking at an America that knows itself to be increasingly secular. Now, John Meacham had his own take on this, as you know he would. He is himself a writer of tremendous skill. He writes a very elegant essay here. He picks up on it, and he writes this, and this is kind of the key paragraph getting to what he sees as the reality. John Meacham writes, "While we remain a nation decisively shaped by religious faith, our politics and our culture are in the main less influenced by movements and arguments of an explicitly Christian character than they were even 5 years ago. I think this is a good thing, good for our political culture, which, as the American founders saw, is complex and charged enough without attempting to compel or coerce religious belief or observance. It is good for Christianity, too, in that many Christians are rediscovering the virtues of a separation of church and state that protects what Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island as a haven for religious dissenters, called the Garden of the Church from the wilderness of the world. As crucial as religion has been and is to the life of the nation, America's unifying force has never been a specific faith, but a commitment to freedom, not least freedom of conscience. At our best, writes John Meacham, we single religion out for neither particular help nor particular harm. We have historically treated faith-based arguments as one element among many in the Republican sphere of debate and decision. The decline and fall of the modern religious rights notion of a Christian America creates a calmer political environment and, for many believers, may help open the way for a more theologically serious religious life." End quote. There's a lot there in one paragraph. That's the essence, I think, of the argument he sets out in the essay, and I certainly do not think he's all wrong here. I do disagree with him in terms of a very simplistic answer that this is a good thing. As I say, I think there is gain. I think there's gain in the clarity. I think there's gain for us in understanding the nature and character and challenge of this new missiological moment in terms of the church and the gospel. But I think there's loss here as well. And, well, for instance, where Mr. Meacham writes that, just to quote it here, he says, "America's unifying force has never been a specific faith, but a commitment to freedom, not least freedom of conscience." I point out in my article posted today at albertmiller.com, the problem is that freedom requires some kind of presuppositional understanding of human dignity. You know, freedom is not a standalone concept. In fact, no concept actually is. It requires a web of different beliefs that make this one concept make sense, that create a plausible environment for freedom to be seen as a human good, for human beings to be trusted with freedom, for the belief to be that human beings are the creatures who, by their very dignity, require freedom as a matter of right. That requires an understanding of humanity that I think is very difficult to sustain outside of the Christian worldview. And I think all you have to do is look around the world and you'll see exactly what it looks like where you try to come up with purely secular understandings of human dignity and human freedom. I think in terms of evangelism, there's great gain here because we understand the challenge is greater than it ever was before, and we have a more honest assessment of what we're up against. We have a more honest diagnosis of the problem that we're really facing, which is millions and millions of persons who need the gospel but are so distant from Christianity that they're no longer even operating out of a Christian memory. Newsweek magazine, the cover story says it all. The decline and fall of Christian America. The inside headline, the end of Christian America. I want to know what you think about this. Maybe you've seen the Newsweek cover story. Maybe you've seen my article both before and after. Maybe you're ready to talk about it. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about Newsweek's cover story, The End of Christian America. John Meacham argues that in a very special sense, he sees this as a good thing. I've been asked by several reporters today why I think John Meacham thinks it's a good thing. And without putting words in his mouth, I think he's given us the words right in his essay. I think he sees religion as too often a divisive issue in terms of our civic conversation, in terms of our cultural controversies, and it's better that that recede and instead other arguments take their place. I think there's more to it than that, however. I think if you're living in a place like New York and operating in an environment where perhaps you're looking at the need for a civil discourse, and above all things, what you want is a more quiet public square. You can see religious folk, regardless of where they're coming from, as kind of noisy, arriving with absolutes and all the rest, and it'd be better perhaps to quiet that down a bit. And so, well, he says that in the paragraph I read. At the very end, he says, perhaps so that we can have a more civil conversation, he says, the decline and fall of the modern religious rights notion of a Christian America creates a calmer political environment. Well, if that's your goal, then perhaps you could see this as good. I don't think, by the way, that's going to happen, because the issues of our contemporary debate are intensely theological, whether you like it or not. We're talking about what it means to be human. We're talking about whether or not a fetus is a human being. We're talking about whether or not the human embryo should have the status of being recognized as possessing human dignity. We're talking about whether marriage is an objective institution of a man and a woman, or whether it can be just about anything. And once you start mixing all those things together, I don't care what you want to call it, you're into theology there. Because if you believe that there is a God who determines these issues, you've got no choice but to make that known. If you believe that there is no God, well, believing that there isn't a God is actually a form of a theological argument. That's why it frustrates the atheists that theism has to be in the very word they call themselves. Let's go to Steve calling from Durango, Colorado. What do you think, Steve?
Hi. I was just thinking about what you're saying about the Northeast. And to me, it's a reflection. I'm sure you're familiar with Francis Schaeffer. And he wrote about how thought progresses through society, how it starts with philosophers, and then it goes into higher education, and then into students, and then further down into society. And I think that the Northeast has been affected by Europe significantly, and they're also prior, there's more exposure to higher education and liberal higher education, and that has gradually worked its way through, and so they're kind of leading the country in that form of thought.
Yeah, Steve, I think there's a lot of very perceptive analysis in your argument there. First of all, thanks always for mentioning Francis Schaeffer. Indeed. In fact, the title of my book on preaching, He Is Not Silent, is a token of appreciation to Francis Schaeffer for his great book, He Is There and He Is Not Silent. I'm very indebted to Francis Schaeffer's thought, and you're exactly right. Schaeffer tracked a trajectory of this kind of thought, and he called it the line of despair at one point, talking about the trajectory of human thought into a secular humanism. But, you know, you're exactly right also to point to the issue of higher education. You look to the American Northeast, and yes, it's the cradle of colonial America. It's the cradle of religious liberty. It's where the Pilgrims established Plymouth, and it's where you had unmistakable Christian identity shaping the culture at large. Not saying they were all Christians and believers and faithful church participants. I am saying that the culture was very clearly, self-consciously shaped by Christian truth, by the Christian narrative, the Christian gospel. But now you look at the influence of higher education. Very quickly in New England, you had colleges that were established on Christian orthodoxy for the training of Christian pastors. You had Harvard and Yale, and Harvard first especially was turning toward the direction of not only liberal theology, but transcendentalism and universalism. Very quick, and Unitarianism is actually the more proper term there, where it quickly turned into anything but a bastion of Christian orthodoxy. And we're not talking about into the 20th century. We're not even talking about well into the 19th century. We're talking about even in the 18th century, but especially in the early 19th century, those kinds of things happened. And Steve, you're exactly right. You start looking at the culture of higher education. You know, it reminds me of the whole question of secularization. And Peter Berger was one of the sociologists who was most pushing the idea of the inevitable secularization of the entire world as it grew more modern. It turns out it didn't happen that way. They did a study of the most secular and least secular nations, discovered that Sweden was the most secular, and India, the nation of India, was the least secular. And looking at the United States, he said, Americans are a society of Indians ruled over by an elite of Swedes. And Steve, those Swedes, so to speak, are predominantly in higher education. Massive influence there. It does filter down. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Good conversation. We're asking the question, is Newsweek right about the end of Christian America? What does it mean? Give me a call, 877-893-8255 on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let me ask, does it look this way where you live? Does it look like the end of Christian America? Are you noticing something shifting on the ground? Whether you are in the Northeast, the Northwest, the Southwest, the Southeast, or anywhere in between, are you noticing that the culture is shifting? Let me give you a couple of anecdotal pieces of evidence. First of all, we have the ARIS study and the Pew Religious Landscape study, which give us the hard facts. The fact is that you are noticing a decline. You are noticing a radical rise, virtually a doubling in 10 years of the numbers of Americans who say that they're religiously unaffiliated, totally unaffiliated. But here's some things to watch on the ground. Even in places associated with the Bible Belt, increasingly, as you go younger in the population, you'll discover increasingly secularized worldviews. And a part of this has to do with what we were talking about earlier with Steve. A part of it does have to do with the impact of higher education. A part of it has to do with the fact that if you take a young person who grows up in the middle of the Bible Belt, and it grows up in a church, and then moves to a state university or a private university or college, the reality is that you can significantly measure a discount, not in every individual. That's not possible either to study nor to assume. But in terms of the generation, you can notice a significant fall off because what happens is that where you have a lot of higher education, given the culture of higher education, the self-referential culture of higher education, you've got pockets of secularization going on there. You have an influence. You also have now people, regardless of where they live, watching the same media, going to the same movies, kind of drinking the same cultural water. That has an impact as well. Because the reality is that whether you're in the Northeast or the Northwest, or anywhere else, especially by generation, you're really watching the same things. It's really very interesting to look at that. You know, if you're an adolescent in Seattle, or in Birmingham, the reality is you're probably talking about a lot of the same television shows. You're probably talking about a lot of the same movies. In terms of cultural heroes, cultural reference, a lot in common there. That's something that's fairly new. The ubiquity of this culture, especially the entertainment and media culture, is something that's basically new, a new phenomenon. And again, whether or not you can generalize this kind of data to your community, you may say, well, it just doesn't look like that. Well, let me just suggest you go to the local college or university, see if it looks a little more like that. And start looking at it generationally. You're likely to find it looks like that. And by the way, one of the things that I wrote about at my at the website at albertmueller.com was what USA Today did very cleverly, doing an overlay analysis of this new report in terms of religious identification and support for same-sex marriage. And there's an almost perfect tracking of this in parallel, which is to say that where you find the highest rates of support for same-sex marriage, you find the lowest identification with Christianity. And to the converse, so where you find the highest identification with Christianity, you find the lowest support for same-sex marriage. Well, by and large, you find the same thing generationally. As you go younger in a generational comparison, you'll notice a great deal more openness to same-sex marriage, a great deal more openness to all kinds of moral revisionism when it comes to matters of sexual lifestyle and sexual practice. So even though you can say, well, right now it doesn't look that way right where I live, it doesn't look that way in Little Rock, it doesn't look that way in Memphis, it doesn't look that way in perhaps Lubbock, well, just give it time. You see, the reality is it certainly didn't look that way in the Northeast. Not if you go back far enough. It didn't look that way in France or in Switzerland or Sweden until more recently. But the process is ongoing. And America has considered itself an exception to this for too long. We've just considered that the rest of the world, the rest of the Western world, is moving in this direction, but not the United States. But it turns out that exceptionalism is just not there. And it's important for us to know it. At least it's not there long term. It's not there as a permanent reality. It's there in terms of the fact that far more Americans go to church than people in Western Europe. But the trends are not moving in that direction, but rather moving towards greater secularization, lower identification with Christianity, lower church participation rates. It's all there. Now, again, I see this as gain for the gospel. You know, one of the problems that we face is cultural Christianity. And we also face the real challenge of moralism, the fact that a lot of people see Christianity as merely a moral system, and there are too many Christians to think that the way to influence the culture is first of all to bring our moral understanding to bear, as if that's our first message. And of course it isn't. Our first message is the gospel. What people need first and foremost is the gospel. But if we're honest, the gospel comes as a message not only of new life in Christ, but also of faithfulness to Christ and discipleship. It comes with a theistic worldview that believes that all things begin, first of all, with the question as to whether or not God speaks to us, and thus we're obligated to hear him on these issues. So Christianity comes with a binding moral address, a binding moral responsibility, which is one of the things I talk about in my interview in Newsweek in this cover story with John Meacham. I point out that the problem is America is still very religious. It's just religious without binding authority. Let's go to Tim calling from Iowa. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I just want to comment on that article. I think it depends on what you mean by Christianity. If you talk about the authentic Christian church, that practices types of disciplines that a lot of churches don't practice anymore, such as say church discipline, you don't see a lot of that anymore. So there is a decline of that type of thing within the church. But on the other hand, I see an incline in younger generations that are coming up under this kind of the neo-Calvinism like they talked about in the Time magazine article that you quoted a couple of weeks ago. I see a lot of young people coming out of some good seminaries in this country that are taking those ideas in a solid biblical inerrancy to the church. And so I kind of see an emergence of that type of thing within the church.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important, and I really appreciate you bringing that up. And as a matter of fact, Tim, John Meacham even gets to that in my article. Let me just read to you. This is the last paragraph of the Newsweek article. Back in Louisville, preparing for Easter, Al Mohler keeps vigil over the culture. Last week, he posted a column titled, "Does Your Pastor Believe in God?" It goes on. He says, Mohler wrote, "This new generation of young pastors intends to push back against hell in bold and visionary ministry. Expect to see the sparks fly." So, in other words, even those who were writing the article, John Meacham, understands that there are contrary signs, and I'm with you, Tim, and that's what keeps me excited about being president of the institution I'm privileged to serve here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I get to look out at hundreds of these young, very committed pastors in training and missionaries in training, and I guarantee you, I wouldn't trade this situation for anything else. And that's why when I look at something like the end of Christian America, I see it first and foremost, theologically, as a great challenge to us in terms of seeing America as a mission field and a real challenge and opportunity for us to show what authentic Christianity looks like. Tim, you're onto something big there. Thanks for your call. We'll be right back with final thoughts on the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, every once in a while you meet yourself in the media and learn something about yourself. Let me just read to you how John Meacham described me in the opening paragraph of this cover story, Newsweek magazine. He says, for a believer like Mohler, and this is what he says, a starched, unflinchingly conservative Christian steeped in the theology of his particular province of the faith, devoted to producing ministers who will preach the inerrancy of the Bible and the gospel of Jesus Christ as the only means to eternal life. I got to tell you, when I look at that, and that's what's between the M-dashes in this argument. Again, he describes me as a starched, unflinchingly conservative Christian, steeped in the theology of his particular province of the faith, devoted to producing ministers who will preach the inerrancy of the Bible and the gospel of Jesus Christ as the only means to eternal life. I love the way that ends, because the passion of my life is to produce ministers who will preach the inerrancy of the Bible and the gospel of Jesus Christ as the only means to eternal life. If nothing else is written in that article, I would rejoice in that. And I am appreciative of the accuracy of that. That's the passion. And I get to see that. That's my joy. Every one of the words in those particular clauses is important to me. He also says, I'm steeped in the theology of my particular province of the faith, end quote. Let me tell you, what I want to be steeped in is Orthodox biblical Christianity. And in the faith once for all delivered to the saints. I pray what I represent is the faith once for all, as Jude says, delivered to the saints. He describes me as a starched, unflinchingly conservative Christian. Well, I certainly want to be understood to be a Christian. Conservative, well, I think in terms of the issues where you earn those labels today, unquestionably. Unflinchingly, well, I hope faithfully. The starched part, well, I guess this is where I learned something new about myself. I guess to the world, I look like a starched person as well. Well, perhaps I'll work at being a little less starchy. I don't want to work at being less faithful. And I certainly don't want to lose one tiny bit of passion for producing ministers who will preach the inerrancy of the Bible and the gospel of Jesus Christ is the only means to eternal life. Folks, I'm going to be on CNN tonight, live at 8 o'clock Eastern Time with Roland Martin, talking about the challenge of Islam. I'm going to be back on with one of my conversation partners with CNN and the Donahue Show and Fox News in the past, and that is Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. It's going to be, well, I can promise you this, it's going to be an interesting evening, and there probably will be plenty for us to talk about. That's tonight on CNN, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, Roland Martin talking about the issue of Islam. Folks, you just never know in a given day what you're going to end up talking about. That's the way it is in terms of the Christian challenge in the present generation. Thanks for listening so that we can think together and talk together about how to be more faithful in facing this challenge. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation on the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.